This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In the introduction to his book, John Greenhoe writes that when he became director of development for Western Michigan University's College of Education in 2001, he became discouraged at how difficult it was to schedule meetings with potential donors of major gifts. Greenhoe says he kept thinking there has to be a better way. John Greenhoe, who is now Major Gift Officer in Western's Office of Development and Alumni Relations, believes he has since found that better way, and he has written about it in his book, Opening the Door to Major Gifts, Mastering the Discovery Call. John Greenhoe, thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How specialized a field is cultivating major gifts?
Well, it is a specialized field. Not everybody does that for a living or really wants to, but it's an important field. And it's something that a lot of organizations need to learn how to do better, frankly, to survive. And it's very interesting.
And how different is trying to get a major gift as opposed to calling someone like myself, who mm-hmm. is not often asked for major gifts? We're often asked for, you know, whatever we can give to an organization like the Red Cross, which you work mm-hmm. for. How separate are these two things?
They are separate. Of course, any gift that's given to a charitable organization is certainly appreciated and welcomed. When you talk about major gifts, it's something that takes longer. And it's something that is it has to happen with a good deal of preparation and a focus on listening to the donor and really making sure that you're fulfilling their needs and perhaps even helping them to do something that they didn't necessarily know they wanted to do in the beginning. You're almost like sort of being a psychologist and thinking about what might motivate them. But it's an interesting thing because a lot of individuals who do end up making major gifts, will actually thank you. So there's an art and a science to it as well.
In a town like Kalamazoo, where there are people who do have means to make major gifts, and we certainly know of some which have been made, perhaps we don't know the names exactly on them, such as the Kalamazoo Promise, large donation to help fund Western Michigan University's medical school. Is there something about trying to make your case that you are a priority, that you're also worth perhaps an investment, anonymous or otherwise?
Absolutely. A priority in the community is important, but I think what probably is even more important is where the donor's heart lies and what they're truly interested in. And I believe that all major gifts really focus around that. It's really making a match between your organization and what are the personal priorities of individual donors. And it's important to focus on individual donors. One of the things that you'll find in charitable organizations, there's a lot of emphasis on foundations and also on special events and direct mail. Those are all wonderful, wonderful things. One of the challenges in philanthropy, though, is that 85% of all giving comes from individuals. It does not come from corporations. It does not come from foundations. It comes from individuals. And that really is one of the reasons for the book.
Let's go back again to, as I noted in the opening here, you found yourself somewhat discouraged in the early days when you were at the College of Education here at Western Michigan University. What are some things that you have learned along the way? What were mistakes that you were making, do you think, when you look back?
Probably the biggest mistake is assuming that a larger portion of the population might consider a significant gift and really being more astute about figuring out what people's motivators are. One of the things I learned through this process is that people want to know kind of what's coming up and what you're planning for them. And so the book is really about one strategy that I have for contacting people to let them be a little bit more relaxed about the process and to really have an awareness of what I'm trying to do and what their potential role might be. And it sounds a little complicated, but basically it is really helping people to be more comfortable with the process and really telling them what we're trying to do. So if we can do those things, then we're going to be successful.
What is a good batting average for getting someone to meet with you to begin with?
Yeah, a good batting average might even be 50%. And I mean, because there is a certain portion of the population that won't meet with you. I find with my method that it's better than that. People typically want to meet with me. I try to present them with a value proposition, something that would be advantageous for them to meet with me. Now, working in higher education, there is an advantage. We have alumni, and there's a natural affiliation there. Now, with the American Red Cross, when I did that prior to coming to Western, that was a little bit different. People have a high regard for the Red Cross, but, you know, being an alum is different. And so I do think there's
more
some
of an
advantages
emotional,
there.
An emotional yeah. connection you might have as an alum.
There are memories, there's history, there are a lot of different things that might motivate someone to, you know, give to their alma mater. And people will give to the Red Cross. Actually, people give very generously to the Red Cross, but it's a different type of a motivator. Typically, many of the gifts that come to disaster relief organizations are spurred by disasters. And so it's a different type of motivation. It's a different type of strategy. And it's a different type of approach, frankly.
So if you get in the front door and, mm-hmm. and you get a chance to meet with someone who might be a potential giver of a major gift, do you then have a certain drop off from there of the people who will actually contribute?
Good question. And really, when you think about that, I mean, the book really talks about it in very simple numbers, and there's no hard and fast number. But if I had to give you a number, I would say that even when you get the meeting, it's probably only going to be half of those individuals who might have potential for a major gift. So if you have 100 people that you're starting with, then by the time you get done interviewing them, say only 50 of them are going to meet with you, you may only have 25 by the time you're done with those 100. So you think about that, and it's numbers driven. You do need to see a lot of people. And that's one of the things that's very, very important in philanthropy is that people working for charitable organizations need to be very good at identifying and qualifying donors. And there are studies out there. The Association of Fundraising Professionals, largest fundraising organization in the world, did a study a couple of years ago that showed that more fundraisers have difficulty with the ID call than they do with the actual solicitation. So you think about that. And I couldn't believe there had never been a book written on this topic before. Yeah. So it's interesting.
And is that a lot of why you decided to undertake this, that these were some things you thought should be in book form? You didn't find it out there and said, well, someone's got to write it. Why not me?
Exactly. Yeah. I had other friends who had written books and they encouraged me to. And I started thinking about it seriously a couple of years ago. And it became very obvious to me that that was the topic that I wanted to focus on, partially because I have spent a lot of time over the last 15 years identifying and qualifying donors. And I actually think I'm pretty good at it. So it was one of those things that I chose. And there are dozens of books on soliciting and asking, but I'd never seen a book on the identification or discovery call, on the qualification call.
As you mentioned, there's some people who see fundraising and sales as very closely related. What are some of the things that make it similar? But then where are some of the lines that separate fundraising from sales?
It's easier to talk about the things that separate the two, because when you're talking about fundraising, you know, you're selling, an object that you really can't, you know, see and touch. It's intangible. And so in sales, you know, you are typically selling a product. You could be selling a service as well, but let's just say it's something that you could, you know, see and touch and feel. So that's the big difference. Where sales and fundraising are very similar is that it's very numbers driven. It is very similar in the way that you approach individual donors. Typically, I recommend in my book that if you're trying to call somebody for the first time, you should try to call them at least 7 times before you decide that maybe they're not going to participate, or that maybe you should try them back in 3 or 6 months. That comes directly from the sales world. The American Marketing Association says it takes 7 phone calls to reach the average C-level executive, CFO, CIO, CEO, et cetera. So it's very direct in that perspective. And when you talked about the 100 and 50 and 25, that's a sales model too. It's numbers driven.
You started in fundraising when, with the American Red Cross?
1998. That was my first time. I had worked with fundraisers before when I worked at Kalamazoo College before that. But in 1998, I was the assistant executive director and also the director of development for the Red Cross. And simultaneously, I was working on my master's degree in philanthropy and development at St. Mary's University in Minnesota. So I've been at it about 15 years now.
Okay. And when you were at Kalamazoo College, your primary job was communication, media relations, that sort of thing, dealing with people like me.
Exactly. Yeah. Media relations has been a great training ground for me. And one of the things I did get to do at K-College was work on the announcement of major gifts to the college. So I became more interested in philanthropy at that time. I just kind of saw how it worked and worked alongside fundraisers and decided that was something I wanted to do. And so I love being at the Red Cross. It was absolutely fantastic. It was just a great experience. I got to do everything. I got to do direct mail and special events and major gifts and planned giving. And then when I had an opportunity to come to Western, I jumped at it because it's really been a fantastic experience working in the development office. And I can't imagine a better day than going out and visiting with alumni and asking them about their careers and kind of, you know, what happened, did we help them? And what advice do they have for students, which is just a favorite question I love to ask. And most alumni are just delighted to answer that because a lot of times they have some really cool things to tell young people, you know, what they should think about when they're studying and how they could, you know, make the maximum opportunity of the studies. And so, and that's the sort of thing that people don't understand about fundraising, because when you go to see someone for the first time, especially when you're someone like me, the last thing you want to do is ask them for a gift. I mean, you really don't want to ask them for a gift on a first visit. I mean, that's not appropriate. You're really getting to know them. And the only time that ever happens is when the prospect or the donor suggests it to me. You know, I'd like to do this. Great. Does it happen very often? Almost never. But it's one of those things that that people don't understand that about fundraising. It's not just going out and asking. There's a lot more than that. Asking is very important, but it's only one step in the process.
And again, it's the idea of building a relationship before you get to the ask, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is an art. Absolutely. The science part is the sales part. I mean, it really is the numbers part. So there, it's a balancing. And that's actually one of the things I really like about fundraising is it takes all these different relationship building models and communications and just takes that and brings it sort of to the really the penultimate opportunity to really kind of define, you know, how you handle your relationship building skills. It's actually a really fascinating area to work in. And some people say, you know, how could you do that? And it's like, well, you know what? It's really, really interesting. It's really interesting. And it's very enjoyable to work with individuals who do decide to do something significant of a philanthropic nature. And you can just kind of see, you know, it opened doors for them. They just really enjoy it. And it's kind of a cool thing. So it's been a lot of fun.
In that 15 or so years that you have been in the field, have you seen some big changes in fundraising and how people go after and try to acquire major gifts?
Yeah, there are a lot of big changes in fundraising. Probably the biggest one is that the professionalization of fundraising has become much more sophisticated than when I started. And that was only 15 years ago. There were fewer training opportunities for development officers, and now there are more higher education opportunities, more training opportunities. There's more people like me sort of, you know, springing up from the woodwork and writing books and things like that, and has become more specialized. So I think that there's more respect for the profession. Every once in a while, I hear a colleague talk about, you know, someone criticizing and calling them beggars or something like that, which is just, you know, sort of crass. But I'm just saying that there has been that side of the profession. I think it's become more ethical. I do believe that there's a lot more emphasis on really doing it the right way. As an example, being a member of the Association of Fundraising Professionals, I subscribe to a code of ethics that says I do not fundraise on a commission or percentage-based, you know, rationale. You're paid a salary. So it's not like you're asking someone for $1 million and you get 10% commission, so you get $100,000. It doesn't work like that. Are there people who do that? Actually, there are. But I mean, they're becoming fewer and fewer. And so I do believe that that's kind of one of the cool things about philanthropy and fundraising is because it has become an emerging profession. And that's really very interesting.
You also, though, wrote on your blog about that goes along with this book, about how some organizations have really not embraced fund development. And say sometimes fundraisers are treated like second-class citizens. In other words, the organization is not taking it as seriously as they should. Is that still a prevalent problem?
Well, it's becoming less and less of a problem, but there are still organizations out there who haven't totally embraced it. And those are the organizations that are eventually going to be in trouble. I mean, when you talk about what's happening with federal funding and what's happening with the budget, I mean, those are all things that are going to cause problems for nonprofit organizations. And the ones who don't take it seriously will inevitably run into some problems, you know, and we've seen some organizations merge and we've seen some organizations go out of business. And we're going to probably see more of that as time moves forward. But we're also going to find that more organizations are going to be better at fundraising and they're actually going to become better at providing transformational opportunities to better serve their clientele, to make possible some things for individuals who are their benefactors. But yes, there are still organizations out there who don't take it seriously. And it's one of the reasons that the book was written is that I do think there are more nonprofits who are saying, you know, we really need a major gifts program. You know, we just can't do, you know, 4 special events and 6 direct mail solicitations. We've got to spend part of that time that we're doing, frankly, more indirect methods of fundraising and do more direct methods of fundraising. There's nothing more direct than face-to-face cultivation and eventual solicitation.
From that same blog post, however, you also write, one of the reasons I wrote Opening the Door to Major Gifts was that I saw a lack of discipline and commitment on the part of a number of fundraisers whom I have known and worked with over the years. Mm-hmm. Now, you say that the profession has, you know, become more professional, but is this still a problem, a lack of discipline, a lack of commitment and some of those sort of things? Or is it becoming less of a problem?
Well, I think it's becoming less of a problem, but is it still a problem? Yes. And, you know, I realize that some of the things I say may be slightly controversial, but I also believe that it needs to be said because I have found in the profession that there are individuals who enter the profession who are newer at fundraising and quickly become discouraged. And I think the reason that they become discouraged is they take it personal. That's part of it. And they don't realize the type of discipline and persistence that's really necessary to really do fundraising well. And so when you talk about, you know, 7 phone calls to reach a prospective donor, that's a foreign method for a lot of people. A lot of people, after they call somebody 2 or 3 times, they're like, well, they're not interested. I can't get a hold of them. Well, there's lots of reasons why somebody might not call you back. And they may not want to talk to you, but they also may be extremely busy. They may have some life event that's going on that, you know, precludes them from getting back to you. So I think that is the biggest area where there's still some work to be done. It's the people who really understand the work, the hard work that's necessary to be a major gift officer. It is a difficult job. It's also a really fun job too, but if you're not willing to work, it will be difficult to be successful in major gifts.
Do you want to write more about this?
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Another book?
Absolutely. There are a lot of things that have been pointed out to me where there are opportunities to expand on the topic. And I do believe that there's a lot more I could do. Actually, on the visit part of the book, there's a lot more I could do. I spend a lot of time talking about preparation. I spend some time talking about the visit, but there's probably a lot more that I could do. And my publisher actually had me write it from my perspective. It was totally about my experiences, but I had other people say to me, you know, why don't you talk to other people in the field and ask them how they do it? That probably will be the second book. This is really supposed to be about me, and so I did write it from that perspective, but I think that surveying the field will be a next step, and spending more time on the actual visit will be another next step. So I think I have thought about another book, yeah.
John Greenhoe, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
John Greenhoe is Major Gift Officer in Western's Office of Development and Alumni Relations. He's also the author of Opening the Door to Major Gifts, Mastering the Discovery Call.